offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem and Hari. We are going to take you through the next part of the 8th chapter or the 8th discourse as part of the 1991 Samukos series. We started it off last week, so we had about 12 minutes of that discourse played. For those of you who are not aware or not following us regularly, the 1991 Samukos series are about the Upanishads. The discourse which we had before this, the 7th discourse, was about the Prashnopanishad. The 6th one also about the Prashnopanishad. So this is the 3rd discourse, which is about the Prashnopanishad, one of the very, very profound and esoteric Upanishads. And we went through a very, very beautiful discourse. The 7th one was laid out very beautifully, and this one's promising to be as good as the earlier one. And only with prayers to Swami that we are able to follow what Swami is saying, and we'll be able to share with all of you our understanding. And those of you who would like to share with us what you understand as the program goes, please do write to us. So before I start with a summary of what we had last week, let's invite Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Prem.
And I think the discourse started off very well, isn't it, last time? I mean, it feels weird to say that it started off very well because we have no one to judge Swami, and every time we tend to say that this discourse is very nice, that discourse is very nice. I remember these people who used to do this very difficult job of translating Swami's discourses, be it Professor Anil Kumar or Professor Nanjundia. Apparently after a discourse, invariably Swami will be apparently in high spirits, you know, Swami will be really excited. And that's an interesting thing about Swami, you know, whenever he is in the act of giving, whether it's a discourse or it's an interview, spending time with somebody, or even giving objects like clothes or saris, or even giving padnamaskar, at the end of it, Swami will be very excited, and you know, you can, it's visibly noticeable that Swami is very happy.
Yes, yes.
So usually after a discourse, when Swami comes backstage, you know, in Vrindavan, or when he goes to the interview, Swami will ask the translator, how was the discourse? Okay. And Anil Kumar sir was saying that, you know, you can't get away by saying, Swami, the discourse was very nice.
Yes, yes.
Swami will ask, what did you like in the discourse?
Pointed questions.
Right? Yeah, Swami will ask, what is good? And you have to mention, you know, what Swami mentioned and what way it was helpful to you,
right,
why you felt that the discourse was good.
Sorry.
You know, because Swami will not just take casual appreciation for, you know, just like that.
And especially when Swami would see multitudes of devotees in front of him, that's when you could clearly see that eagerness, you know, to share himself,
right,
with everybody. Like Swami would say, you know, I will not be able to personally go and talk to each one of you, but but you can see that he so much wants to,
right,
that this was his way of accomplishing through discourses. It was his way of talking to like each person there in the hall. And many times you would have heard, no, people would say that they came to that that evening with so many questions in their mind, and Swami would answer them all. You know, maybe to somebody sitting and trying to follow what Swami is saying, it would sound like a break from what was being spoken about. But it is like a particular devotee there. He has that query in his mind. Maybe it has arisen very strongly, and Swami is actually addressing that. Several times we have heard, no, people mentioning this.
Once when we were talking to an old student, Dr. Veerabhadra Rao, right now he's, I think, the vice chairman of the UK organization there.
Right.
He was talking about how his father came to get attracted to Swami.
Now,
he came from a very, very traditional family.
I see.
But he was a scientist. Right. So he began questioning a lot of the rituals which were done. You know, why do you light agarbattis? Why do you give aarti with a camphor? And why do you do these rituals? And he would constantly keep asking these questions to the elders in the family. And he would never get the right answers. So he had a standard list of questions which he never could get satisfying answers for. So apparently when he was once driving past a place where Swami was giving a discourse in Hyderabad, he got caught in the traffic. He was coming by scooter, he got caught in the traffic. So not being able to move forward, he happened to hear the discourse which Swami was giving to a gathering in that area. And point after point, Swami cleared all of these questions that he had in his mind. Right? So that was how he was pulled to Swami. And probably the idea that Swami is divine came much later.
Mm.
But whenever he came to know that Swami is giving a discourse somewhere, he would go and attend it, because he felt that, you know, here is someone who is able to so beautifully synthesize rational thinking with, you know, traditional values and practices.
Yes, yes. That way, Swami was the repository of all wisdom, and we've seen it in evidence. The last two editions of the Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam, we've been clearly seeing, you know, it gives us an opportunity to delve deep into, like, what Swami is speaking about. And the profundity, you know, even, like, with whatever little I know, we can still, you know, sometimes we are stunned at what we hear during the discourse. One more thing I recall, you know, like, I remember one of the birthday functions that was held in the Hillview Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is usually like every fifth birthday, and the organization always wants to celebrate it in a very grand fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And they had organized so many things, like, you know, dance programs, and there were so many, almost like entertainment that had been scheduled for the day. So, a lakh people, you know, 100,000 people gathered. And at that time, you know, Swami was so eager that he should speak to the devotees. He made it very clear to the organizers. He said, they have not come here to watch your music programs and the dance programs. They have come here to listen to Swami. And Swami was like, whatever be his physical state, you know, we used to see towards the end, like, even if he could not stand, because for Swami to stand and give a discourse, that was something, you know, he felt was his sacred duty. And he would do it even when the body was not cooperating. He would still insist on standing and delivering the discourse. I can, you know, so many instances I've seen where Swami used to wait impatiently for when the program would get over, you know, so that he could share what, you know, what the devotees had really come for.
Now, I remember many times when Swami used to be in Vrindavan, we used to have these tri sessions. So invariably tri sessions would be a couple of teachers speaking and Swami would informally interact. Once in a while Swami would give a discourse. But invariably on a Sunday Swami would always give a discourse. And I remember when we were a student, one day Swami in the course of that discourse said, Swami pointed out to a few boys, you know, from the trust who had come, because they would come during the weekends to have Swami's darshan.
Right.
Some of the hospital boys, Swami mentioned a few names and Swami said, because these boys are here and they have an interest in what Swami says. When I see them, I wish to give a discourse.
Right.
So, I mean, that was very, very moving what Swami said, because, you know, as you're saying, Swami is definitely the repository of wisdom. He is there to give, but are we there to seek?
Yeah.
The moment that interest is there in us, it's almost like, you know, Swami would say, you know, the cow starts, you know, producing milk, seeing the calf. It's almost like the mother cow sees the calf and, you know, there is that desire to feed the calf, and that, you know, results in the production of milk. It's almost like that, you know, can we have that kind of interest by which we can draw that wisdom from Swami? And really, how fortunate we are that after so many decades, we can go back to those discourses and listen to them again.
And when you were mentioning that how Swami would ask the translator, like after the discourse, like how it was, I remember, see, sometimes it would happen, say, a festival day, and Swami would give a discourse in the Sai Ramesh Hall in Whitefield, and then in Vrindavan. And then immediately after, we would all assemble in Trai. And again, Swami would be prepared to, you know, speak to all the students. And this would be like a distillation of what was said in the, you know, in the Sai Ramesh Hall. And I had a couple of seniors, you know, who were doing their PhD, and I had a nice rapport with them. And they were very fortunate that during those summer vacations, Swami had given them the chance to, you know, do duty in the same bedroom, like where Swami would sleep. So they would also lie down, like, security, you know, around Swami's bed. It's a golden chance for them. So I used to be very inquisitive, you know, what happens inside, what, you know, transpires. And they said, see, every evening when Swami speaks in Trai, in the night before Swami retires, Swami would again talk about those points, which the core points, you know, which Swami raised. We could ask him questions and then Swami would clarify. So Swami would literally live that same message the entire day. You know, it was like on a physical level, it is something that has been strongly on his mind. And that's what he shares with us all. That's the amount of energy, enthusiasm, eagerness, you know, that goes into.
Yeah, I think Hari, you will have to hold me, and I'll have to hold you back.
Definitely, yeah.
Because and
do our duty here.
Your listeners, I think this will be the most casual banter of this episode, because what's coming is quite heavy in that sense.
Very heavy. Yes.
Swami is. I mean, that's the beauty, you know. Swami starts off with a theme or a poem which has a theme which is quite different from what flows immediately. But the way Swami connects back to that, and many times mentioned this, Swami would tell the boys when they are preparing for a talk. Swami would, you know, personally train boys to give speeches and all that, and during the Vidwan Mahasabha when boys would speak. An analogy which Swami would always tell is, your speech should be like stringing a pearl necklace. You know, it should end where it begins.
Right.
And when people listen to it, they should see the completeness. That you started with a theme and you have come to that theme again.
Correct.
And that's precisely what we see in the previous discourse. It was so beautiful that Swami starts with that theme of, you know, how offering everything to God will release you from birth and death. And how after going through all the concepts of prana, prani, uttarayanam, dakshinayanam, Swami came back to that concept and, you know, completed
connected
that
it all.
Very beautifully presented. So this discourse, Swami talks about the importance of purity of the mind. And Swami started with that wonderful padyam where he said, you know, as long as, you know, does a guileless person need to do sacrifices and rituals?
Yeah.
I was saying that, you know, that is the idea. The whole of this process, I mean, it says, lead you to chitta shuddhi or purification of the mind. So once you reach that state of guilelessness or that innocence of a child, you don't need sacrifices and rituals. And the others, why does a self-realized person need penance? And of what need is spiritual effort to one who adheres to truth.
Truth, yeah.
Right? So that's the padyam that Swami started with.
Then we went through, like Swami took us through the different stages of consciousness. And which was prompted by the question which that disciple asked the sage. So the question is very deep, like who is it that sleeps? Then who is awake when the person is asleep, and when the person is asleep, who is it that is dreaming? Right. So with these questions, and then, you know, Swami takes us through very profound. You know, last time I think we had that discussion on the various pranas, the vital forces, how they remain alive.
Right.
You know, like even when the senses have all been withdrawn, the prana, the vital airs, they remain alive. And like as you said, the Upanishad was very beautifully describing it like a city. The denizens of the city have gone to sleep, but there are five fires in the city that are burning. Right, with that analogy, they created the how the different stages, and finally it is like the in the dream state, like as the Upanishad, when you go into deep sleep, it is like they mention the one of the vital airs, the Udana. It carries the soul, so to speak, the individual soul, to the Brahman, and so that is how, you know, the like the Swami was saying. Swami often says that like death is a long sleep and sleep is a short death, and the beauty, the truth of that, it becomes very evident in this in these verses. Then I think so that's where we stopped last time. So I think we can play.
And Swami was of course talking about that what happens in the dream state apart from
that is important to bring up.
The Udana aspect which you mentioned. Swami was talking about how a lot of impressions from, you know, past births come up in your mind, you know, when you dream. And I think that's a very beautiful thing. The interesting thing whenever Swami speaks about this, even the 1990 summer course when Swami spoke, most of it is something which we have all experienced. You know, when you talk about out-of-body experiences, or you talk about the state of mindlessness, I mean, that not many of us can really relate to. But when you talk about states which have gone through, you know, when Swami speaks about the role of the senses and things like that, I mean, we have experienced it in everyday life. And that's what happens in this part when Swami is talking about the dreams. Because many times we see, you know, what we behave in society, will be quite different from the way we will react in a dream.
Mm.
Right? Many times you would see that hidden fears will come out.
Yes.
You know, when put in a situation, you will be able to sense the fear which is running through your mind in the dream.
Yeah.
And many times that's our true nature.
In a sense, it's a very clarifying thing. Right. A lot of, as you were mentioning, a lot of life situations, problems, it is through dreams that it gets resolved.
Right.
You know? Even scientific problems, right. So many of them got resolved.
Kekulé, the most classic example.
Yeah, the benzene molecule structure.
Right.
Yeah. And one of the most important things I think which we came across in the last segment was also this, how Swami says that this is how the mind, it creates the environment. One creates even oneself during dreams. And we saw that, you know, even in this life, right, our everyday life, it is essentially the mind spinning out a story.
Right.
Right. And it is like we undergo all these experiences, and one takeaway for us is like for us to question, like, you know, it's not to be drawn into the story or sucked into the story of what we see around us, but to actually question. And maybe that is the pathway to reality.
Right. In fact, this is almost like a, you know, the point which Swami ended with the previous discourse, where Swami said, sankalpas are the cause for creation.
Yes.
And it's almost an explanation of that, how that comes forth.
Yes. And I think the next section we'll actually be seeing an elaboration or a connection between the pranava, the omkara, and the, you know, states of consciousness, states of sleep, that from this the discussion forwards on to the nature of pranava itself.
Okay.
So
right. So we'll go to the next clip. This is the third clip we're playing in that discourse.
ఈ విధమైనటువంటి యొక్క సమాధానము సౌర్యాయనుడికి చెప్పుచుండగా,
while giving this kind of reply to సౌర్యాయని,
ఆరవ శిష్యుడైనటువంటి శిబి అందులో ప్రవేశించి,
the sixth disciple శిబి entered into,
స్వామి అంత్యకాలం నందు ప్రణవమును చింతించుతూ ఉండినటువంటి మానవులకు అక్షర ప్రాప్తి లభించునని శాస్త్రములు ప్రబోధిస్తున్నవి.
స్వామి, స్క్రిప్చర్స్ డిక్లేర్ దట్ ద వన్ హూ రిపీట్స్ ప్రణవ అట్ ది ఎండ్ ఆఫ్ హిస్ లైఫ్ విల్ బి ఏబుల్ టు రీచ్ ది అక్షర స్టేట్,
అనగా శాశ్వతమైనటువంటి స్థానము చేకూరుతుందని శాస్త్రములు బోధిస్తున్నాయి.
ది స్క్రిప్చర్ స్టేట్ దట్ యు గెట్ a permanent state from which there is no return.
Idi sadhyama?
Is it possible, Swami?
Appudu pippiladukudu,
pippilada then,
nayana sibi,
child sibi,
prapanchamantayi kudanu pranavamtone nindi untunnadi.
The entire world is permeated and full of pranava.
Pranavamu paramatma swarupamu.
Pranava is the very form of Paramatma, Supreme Lord.
Pranavamunandali akara ukara makaramulu yokka tattvamu chetane,
the various akara ukara makara which constitute this pranava,
ee bhur aneetvanti ee lokamunandunu,
in this world called bhu,
deenikante unnatamainatvanti sthayi antante bhuvar lokamunanu,
in the higher loka called bhuvar,
దీనికంటే అన్నింటికంటే ఉత్తమ స్థానం సువర్ లోకమును,
ది హైయెస్ట్ వరల్డ్ సువర్,
ఈ త్రిలోకమునందు కూడాను సర్వవ్యాపకమై అనుభవించేటువంటిది ప్రణవమే.
ఇన్ ఆల్ దీస్ త్రీ వరల్డ్స్ ఇట్ ఇస్ ది ప్రణవ విచ్ ఇస్ ఎంజాయ్డ్.
ఈ ప్రణవమునందే ఋగ్వేద యజుర్వేద సామవేద వేదములు కూడాను అంకితమవుతున్నాయి.
You can find all these three Vedas, Rugveda, Yajurveda and Samaveda in Pranava.
ఈ త్రయ వేదముల యొక్క స్వరూపం కూడాను, శబ్దమును కూడాను ఓంకారం నందే తన యొక్క పల్లవిని పాడుతున్నవి.
ఆల్ ది సౌండ్స్ ఇన్ దీస్ త్రీ వేదాస్ ఆర్ బేస్డ్ అపాన్ ది ప్రణవ అండ్ దే ఆర్ సింగింగ్ ది వేరియస్ వర్షన్స్ ఆఫ్ ప్రణవ.
కనుక ఈ యొక్క భూర్భువ సుమనటువంటి యొక్క తత్వములు త్రిలోకములకే కాక, త్రివేదములకే కాక, త్రిమాత్రలకు కూడాను సంబంధించినటువంటిదిగా ఉంటున్నది.
These principles and worlds of Bhur, Bhur and Suvar are not merely three worlds, but they are three matras also.
Anaga akara ukara mule matrale.
This akara ukara makara, these are matras.
భూర్భువస్వల్లోకములే ఈ త్రిలోకములు.
దీస్ త్రీ వర్డ్స్ ఆర్ భూర్ భూర్ అండ్ స్వర్.
ఋగ్వేద యజుర్వేద సామవేదములే త్రయీ వేదములు.
ది త్రీ వేదాస్ ఆర్ ఋగ్వేద యజుర్వేద అండ్ సామవేద.
ఏతావాత సర్వత్ర ప్రణవనాదమే కేవలం స్వరంగా నిండి ఉంటున్నది.
ది సమ్ వన్ సబ్స్టెన్స్ ఆఫ్ ఆల్ దిస్ ఈజ్ ఇట్ ఇస్ ది ప్రణవ విచ్ ఇస్ ఫౌండ్ ఎవ్రీవేర్.
ఈ ప్రణవమునకు అష్టైశ్వర్య స్వరూపం అని కూడా మరొక పేరు.
అనదర్ నేమ్ ఫర్ దిస్ ప్రణవ ఈజ్ వన్ ఫుల్ ఆఫ్ ఎయిట్ టైప్స్ ఆఫ్ వెల్త్ అష్టైశ్వర్య స్వరూప.
శబ్ద బ్రహ్మమయీ చరాచరమయీ జ్యోతిర్మయీ వాంగ్మయీ నిత్యానందమయీ పరాత్పరమయీ మాయామయీ శ్రీమయీ సర్వైశ్వర్యమయీ సదాశివమయీ ఓంకార స్వరూపిణం. శబ్ద బ్రహ్మమయీ చరాచరమయీ జ్యోతిర్మయీ వాంగ్మయీ నిత్యానందమయీ పరాత్పరమయీ మాయామయీ శ్రీమయీ అష్టైశ్వర్యమయీ సదాశివమయీ మాం పాహి ఓంకార స్వరూపిణం.
దీస్ ఎయిట్ టైప్స్ ఆఫ్ వెల్త్ ఆర్ శబ్ద బ్రహ్మ సౌండ్ ద మూవింగ్ అండ్ అన్మూవింగ్ వరల్డ్ లైట్ అండ్ నిత్యానంద.
అనగా ఈ జగత్తునందు సమస్త విధములైనటువంటి శబ్దములన్నీ కూడాను ఓంకారం యొక్క ప్రతిరూపములే.
దట్ మీన్స్ ఆల్ ది సౌండ్స్ దట్ యు హియర్ ఇన్ ద వరల్డ్ ఆర్ వేరియస్ వర్షన్స్ ఆఫ్ ఓంకార అలోన్.
ఈ ఓంకార తత్వాన్ని కేవలము భౌతికమైన లౌకికమైనటువంటి యొక్క భావముగా గుర్తించి ఏదో ఓం ఓం అని అనుకుంటూ పోయినటువంటి వారికి కేవలం భౌతికమైన ఫలములే లభిస్తుంటాయి.
దిస్ సౌండ్ ఓంకార ఇఫ్ వన్ అట్టర్స్ ఇన్ ఎ ఫిజికల్ వే అండ్ ఇన్ ఎ వర్ల్డ్లీ సెన్స్ హిస్ బెనిఫిట్స్ ఆల్సో విల్ బి జస్ట్ దట్ మచ్.
కాని ఓంకారమును మననం చేస్తూ మానసిక సంబంధమైనటువంటి యొక్క భావము చింతించినటువంటి వారికి కేవలము చంద్రలోక ప్రాప్తి లభిస్తుందని కూడాను శాస్త్రం యొక్క ప్రమాణము.
ద శాస్త్రస్ హావ్ డిక్లర్డ్ దట్ ఫర్ పీపుల్ హూ గో ఆన్ చాంటింగ్ ఓంకార విత్ అ ఫుల్ ఆఫ్ ఫీలింగ్ మెంటలీ విల్ బి ఏబుల్ టు రీచ్ ది మూన్ చంద్రలోక.
So that was the next clip, and as you mentioned, this is about the pranava or omkara.
Yeah, the omkara, I was just thinking, you know, if there's anything that a person is not like entirely into Hinduism, but you know, somebody, when you say Hindu, the word Hindu, I think the next immediate association comes
symbol
om,
is right? Om,
yeah, the omkaram or the pranava, that I think that is one of the most fundamental teachings of the Vedas. In fact, and the very mystical sound, and Swami used to variously describe it almost as it is the basis of the universe. It's like right. the sound that you hear, like when all sounds have subsided. He says that is the omkaram. Like you could almost imagine that as the hum of the universe, right?
Right. In fact, you know, when Swami talks about creation, I don't know whether in this series Swami mentioned that of you know, how the Panchabhutas come, you know, the first one is more than the gross elements, what Swami was referring to as Tanmatras. Mm-hmm. Right? They are the pre-elements, literally in that sense,
mm-hmm.
where the first one is actually Akasha.
Mm.
And the attribute of Akasha is Shabda, yes. Swami would say.
Mm.
So it is, you know, the first manifest form of divinity, which was otherwise attributeless, is supposed to be sound.
Yes.
And Swami would say that sound is the Omkara, and literally it's almost like the canvas on which the rest of the painting is done.
Exactly.
You know, the basis of everything else.
Yes. Like every sound in this, I remember Swami used to, in many discourses, he had even indicated like how the Om, the Pranava, how it is to be chanted. You know, he would say it should sound like an aeroplane. Mm. You know, he would give that
Doppler effect.
Yeah, it's like as if the sound is coming from far and then it comes close to you and then again fades away. Right? Right. And he would indicate the lengths, like each syllable, it consists of three syllables, A, U and Ma. And to the lengths, you know, the relative lengths, you know, ratios right. in which you should chant. And Swami would say that's when it is the most efficacious. So the Om is to be chanted in a very particular fashion.
Right.
And also, like if one goes through the Upanishads, a lot of the Upanishads, they hold up this mystical sound or these three syllables as like being the basis of the world.
Mm.
And even over here, we see like Swami is saying, equating it to, at one time Swami says it is like the three worlds.
Mm.
We have the Bhuloka, we have the, which is the physical world we all stay in. And then there's the Bhuvarloka, which is the astral world. And then the highest, you know, the causal, Suvarloka. So these, the three syllables, they represent that. And in fact, the Upanishads say that the combination of these three syllables, when we say Om, it represents the state which is even beyond these. It's called the Mahat, you know, the state which is beyond all this, where Brahman resides. And similarly, we have how these syllables also represent the Rig, the Yajur and the Samaveda.
Right.
So, the symbol, this mystical sound, it has so much significance in the Vedas.
Right.
In fact, there is the Mandukya Upanishad,
which
actually follows pretty much the same flow.
Okay.
Even in the Mandukya Upanishad, the discussion begins with the states of consciousness. Like how there is, we have the waking state, and then we have the state, dreaming state, and then the Sushupti, where you are in deep sleep. And also, then comes Turiya, the fourth state. So, after speaking about the fourth state of consciousness is when the Upanishad then start changes track, as it were, to speak about Om, the Pranava. And then we see that the Upanishad says that this Om is equivalent to that state of Turiya. It is the vehicle through which you enter into that you know, state of Brahman. So it is like equated to so many things, the states of time. You know, we see that the past, present and the future. So the Upanishad says like that also is Om. Then the states of consciousness. In fact, it says the state of the Atma itself.
Okay.
Like it is the same, you know, divine consciousness which is undergoing these different states. So those are also, the Om represents that and the state which is beyond. So in so many different ways it is hailed, Om.
Because, you know, when you asked me, I'm reminded of the various ways. You know, it's very clear. It's definitely one of the most significant concepts in the Vedanta.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know, in one of the summer courses, Swami gave an entire discourse on Pranava. I think it's the chapter itself is named as Pranavopasana or something. In one of the summer courses, Swami gave that discourse. But, you know, a concept such as this, Swami made it so very accessible to us by the way Swami put it to us. I remember a couple of things that Swami would say. Swami would say that every one of you have a hot link to God. You know, you have a telephone line. Okay, and you just have to dial up and you can listen to God.
Right.
Swami would say, what is God's number? God's number is three ohms.
Swami
would say. You know, and whenever you are able to sit silently and calm your mind and chant three ohms, you have the ability to directly connect to Swami.
Exactly.
Say that. And I remember even this practice of chanting three ohms before we start bhajans. Apparently, one of her brothers was saying that one of the early discourses, I think 60s or 70s, Swami, you know, very graphically says it. He said, when you're chanting the three ohms, think of it this way. When you chant the first om, wherever you're doing it, you know, your center or samiti or something, when you chant your first om, Swami starts from Puttaparthi. And second om, he has already reached the doorstep.
Right.
Okay. When you chant the third om, Swami comes and sits on the throne.
Yes.
And then, you know, so very easily accessible, Swami has made this concept. Because at least that way, you know, because these are sounds. I remember one of our brothers sharing something about the Vedas, not typically about the Omkar, brother Sonuram Shankar. Right? Once he was telling that when he went to Japan, there were these lot of youngsters who wanted to learn Vedas from him, and they came and they asked him to take classes.
Mm.
So he started off with 1 hour classes a week.
Mm.
Right? But those people, and these are not Indians, they are natives of Japan.
Mm.
They were so very interested in Vedas because Swami was giving so much importance to it.
Mm.
So they would tell him, no, brother, you take for longer durations.
Mm.
And they would have classes sometimes going up to 3 or 4 hours.
Oh.
And they would be so disciplined and so wrapped in attention.
Mm.
And Sonu was saying that, you know, it gave him a chance to, you know, for to chant Vedas for such an extended period of time, focusing so much on it. And he said, it's not once or twice, many, many times I've experienced a state where my mind was not thinking of anything.
Yes.
It's purely because that sound was, you know, constantly hitting my mind. And the only thing I can think of is, you know, when you talk of the Vedas, you call them the Shrutis, right? They were not created by anybody, but they were heard by the Rishis.
Mm.
And Swami would explain that these were sounds which were heard in a state of mind where the mind was absolutely inactive or passive.
Mm.
So it's almost like it's a reverse thing which happens. When you constantly listen to the sound, it has the ability to take your mind to that state which it was got. And similarly, same thing, I think, in one of those discourses, Swami says that when everything was stilled, you know, it's almost like you're muting all the sounds which are there in your mind, internally and externally, and then you kind of see this sound which is the background of everything else.
Right.
So, listening to this sound again and again and again, you know, has the ability to, as Swami says, all the chitta vrittis start to settle down when you start constantly listening to that sound.
Yeah. A devotee actually had shared with me, so this was during that time when Swami had just initiated the chanting of Vedam as a daily routine in the mandir. And I was of course lucky to be part of that the group that would chant every day. But for me it was like Swami has told and it's an opportunity to sit very close to Swami and chant in front of him. Till a devotee shared, you know, that his sister, he was very concerned about her health because she had been undergoing a lot of fluctuations in blood pressure, in her blood pressure. So they tried medicine and nothing seemed to be keeping it stable.
Mm-hmm.
And so he invited her. He said, why don't you spend a couple of days in Prashanthi Nilayam and, you know, we'll see what happens. So he said that since the day she started sitting in Mandir and listening to the chanting of Vedam in Swami's presence, he saw that, you know, her blood pressure then began to stabilize.
Oh.
What medicine couldn't achieve.
Mm-hmm.
He said the fortnight that she spent in Prashanthi Nilayam, with that her health was completely restored with the chanting of Vedam.
Mm-hmm.
He said for years they had been trying. But he said this is what clicked finally. And also when you were mentioning, you know, what brother Sonuram and he and a couple of other students, their efforts in Japan, but what, you know, it was matched by their eagerness, their enthusiasm to learn.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He had shared with me that there were, in the Japanese alphabet or in, you know, the words, there are some sounds from Sanskrit which could not, cannot be even written in that script, in the Japanese script. So they invented, you know, a combination of letters to represent like this symbol. So, you know, they were that dedicated, diligent, and now I remember once a group of Japanese devotees had come here and chanted in front of Swami.
Mm.
And Swami was so proud of them. Mm. You know, he kept looking at us and said, like, watch them. You know, it was for us, it is an education, you know, in how much we have to revere these ancient, you know,
actually,
repositories.
They even staged a drama in which they had spoken about it. I remember mentioning that. I think this was later, 2012, when they had come. There was that nuclear disaster which happened in
Fukushima
reactor. You know, that time, a lot of people were actually leaving the country and, you know, going to some other country. The people who had come from outside, you know, other citizens, they were definitely leaving. And apparently, Brother Sonu and few others, they extended their stay so that they could stay and, you know, be of some help in those tsunami affected areas.
Mm.
And the government was discouraging people from going there because, you know, the infection levels were very high. Apparently, this group of youngsters, of which even Brother Sonu was a part of, they went there and they said, don't worry, Swami has said that Mrityunjaya Mantra, Trayambakam, is very powerful. And we'll keep chanting that, nothing will happen to us. And they were right in the middle of the place where, you know, all of this, the, whatever you call that, this radiation one was very high, radiation was very, very high in the water and all that. They went there, they served for many, many days, they came back, not one of them were affected by, you know, this one there.
What more can you say?
Right? What more can you say, really?
I think we'll return to... I think it's very easy to get sidetracked the moment we start talking about, you know, Swami's glory, even when it pertains to the discourse. Yeah, just going back to, you know, the discourse proper, I was just mentioning about how the various Upanishads, they discuss about the Omkaram. I was fascinated by especially the Samaveda. Like that, in the Samaveda, the Om is given a different name. It's called the Udgita.
Okay.
And like a song, it is considered as a chant or a song in itself. So, while the Chandogya Upanishad, it places a lot of emphasis for a large section of the discourse is about, a large section of the Upanishad is about the various sacred chants. But among them, the Om is given the highest, you know, importance. And the way they describe is, they say the essence of all beings is earth. And of earth is water, and so on. They keep investigating what is the essence of each such element, right? So from water it goes to plants, man, and then they say the essence of man is speech, like the word, right? And then the essence of speech is the Rigveda, you know, the very first Veda. Then again the essence of the Rigveda they say is the Samaveda. Like you can go like speech. The essence of speech is song. Like the Samaveda is this. Is a chant, right? So Sama essentially means like a song. And they say the essence of the song itself is Om. And say that is why we should worship this Om as like being the primary, the primeval sound. So that is among the first, you know, Upanishads where it is detailed, spoken in great detail about almost 2-3 sections of the Chandogya Upanishad are entirely devoted to the discussion on the pranava. So we can never really fathom, you know, what they could perceive with their intuition or their experience, but we can, you know, at least heed their teachings, what they have said.
I mean, precisely what Swami was saying here when he was chanting that shloka, which many times when Swami is speaking about Om, Swami speaks of that Shabda Brahmamai. Swami says, you know, Omkar is God as sound. He is the essence of the living and the non-living. It is in the light. It is the essence of speech. The essence of eternal happiness, transcendental principle. The power of delusion or maya, auspiciousness.
Right.
Prosperity and permanent awareness. Swami says, the essence of Lord Shiva. Swami was going on saying, and very, very beautifully, Swami repeated that thing again.
Yes.
And Swami would very often say this, you know, I think, other faiths also speak of that. That, you know, first there was God and then came the word. It's pretty similar to what we speak of as pranava. Literally, it's like the manifestation began with the sound, and that the basis of all that is that sound, the pranava.
Yes. In fact, I remember when we used to chant Vedam in front of Swami, one thing Swami would insist is that every of the mantras we begin, we should make sure we say Om. See, sometimes what happens is like when we are chanting a series of mantras, it's very natural for us to just begin with, you know, the starting verse of the next mantra. But Swami would make sure, always start a mantra by saying Om and then complete it with Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Right? And Swami would say that actually it is that sound Om which is carrying your prayer to the Godhead. I've heard, read Swami in some discourse that Swami had given, I think, to the students, where he mentions this. So he says that it is through Om. So that's why make sure that even when you're chanting the Gayatri, for example. So make sure you say Om and then start with Bhur Bhuvah Svaha. Swami would insist that it should start with the... So to make every mantra efficacious, Swami would say begin it with the syllable Om. Mm. And that would make sure that it reaches God.
Mm.
And there's so many beautiful descriptions, you know, like some in the Shikshavali, the way it is mentioned, no? It says that this is the sheath of Brahman.
Okay.
And in fact, it just goes on to praise it like all over, starting by saying that Om Itidagum Sarvam, like mm-hmm. everything is Om. There's nothing in this universe that is not Om.
Right.
It is like the primeval vibration, you know, that it permeates the entire world, it permeates everything that is there in this world, and the Upanishads go on to say that not only this world, but the other two, you know, the astral world and the causal world also. So what we perceive in this world as a sound, like that permeates even the, you know, the higher worlds too. And it's a very nice way of putting it. So you imagine that there is a priest, there's a yajna going on. So you say Om, and then there is it gives the example that there is the priest called the Advaryu. And so he responds with a particular mantra. And then with that same mantra, the priest, the other priest who is, you know, it's called the Brahma, the chief priest, then he gives the assent. Like he says, okay, now you can make the sacrifice. And once the sacrifice is offered, it is, you know, the Brahma, you know, who is receiving, the person who is receiving, and then he confers the blessing.
Okay.
So in this way, you know, the kind of the loop is complete. Right. So how Swami said that you preface every mantra with Om. The Shikshavali actually elaborates on that. When you say Om, you know, the Advaryu, the priest, he responds. And then the chief priest, the process kind of initiates. And then he offers to the sacrificial fire. And finally, the God then responds with the blessings. And it goes on to say that so far as even the Vedic sages who aspire to reach the state of Brahman, they say that they chant the syllable Om. And as they chant the Om, at some point of time they enter the state of Brahman and they become one with Brahman. So that is the, you know, meditation, the effects of the meditation on Brahman. And over here actually Swami even alludes to like how this meditation on Om should be done. And Swami says that for those to whom Om is just a sound, right, which is like you don't, you do it like a mechanical recitation, then Swami says that you only receive the worldly benefits. And for those who contemplate on the significance of Om, you know, then they are able to live in the world that Swami says, as we've seen in the previous discourses, the Chandraloka. So we should remember that what with Chandraloka, the association is that when we do certain actions and we attain Chandraloka, we receive the benefits of that, you know, whatever the merits of what we have done. And at some point of time, you know, once that is exhausted, we come back to the world of men, the normal world. So Swami is, you know, he is delineating like how we should be chanting the Om. And even in the Prashnopanishad that is spoken of as being the, you know, when the meditation on the three syllables. So the Om is composed of three syllables, A, U and Ma. And so in the Upanishad it speaks of the different benefits that accrue to someone who meditates on A, you know, while chanting Om. So that is a symbolic way of saying that if your mind is on the material benefits, that's precisely what you'll receive.
Okay.
And when you chant when you're meditating on the syllable U, when you chant Om, then where you are taken to is, as it says, it is to the Chandraloka. So after your death, you are carried to there, to that loka where you enjoy the benefits of whatever sadhana you have done. And then it says when you now concentrate on the highest world, right, the Suvarloka. So that's when it takes you to the sun, the what we saw as the Uttarayana, right? The journey, the northward journey to the sun, which is where you reach when your sadhana has only the Godhead in mind. You're not looking at the material pleasures, You're not even looking at the physical, like the benefits that you would want in this particular world itself, immediate pleasures, not even that. So, Swami is also saying that we must have the highest result in mind. So, the same theme once again, that how must we conduct our sadhana? There is sadhana which can be done for various, like we can pray to God for immediate benefits of people who are dear to us or even our own, and God will respond with that. And then again there is sadhana which is performed with the idea that maybe my next life should be better. You know, that I have done so many sins, let me repent for this and maybe let me do some good deeds so that I get a better life. And God says, yes, okay, you will receive your better life. You know, whatever better things you aspired for, you'll get all those. But then a time will come when that is done. You've exhausted that. Now what? See, back to that cycle. So that's why Swami says, you know, keep the sadhana with only one objective in mind, that I should reach God.
Right.
And when that is done, Swami deems that as the highest sadhana.
No, when Swami says, makes this point that when you look at Omkar only as a sound, this is what happens. And when you look at it as its significance, you know, it's when you say the significance of Omkar, it becomes like the basis of all sounds. It's a completely different thing. I think that's what happens. And you know, when you were saying that if you ask for this, this is what you'll get. If you ask for something higher, you'll get that. And something, if you ask for the highest, that's what you'll get. I think many times when we observe our mind, it is not in our control what we ask. You know, when put in a situation, we spontaneously ask for something which we have no control over.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's what precisely happens when you go through life. You put in different situations. Literally, you get a peek view into your own mind, what your mind will ask for. I mean, listening to this discourse, I can't get up and say that henceforth, I will not ask for small things. And, you know, that's what when Swami starts the discourse by saying, reaching a state where you're guileless, reaching a state where you're good and you're truthful. It's going to be really interesting to see how Swami is going to connect that with this. And Swami is saying that meditate upon the Om, understanding its significance. Now, where does the idea of goodness, where does the idea of righteousness fit into that?
Correct.
I think that's where we usually miss out. You know, I think the last discourse we discussed that to an extent. You know, the famous saying is there, the greatness, I mean the goodness which was lost in trying to be great. You know, literally that's what happens when we are pursuing an idea of which is so very esoteric. We forget that to almost every discourse Swami finally comes down to, you know, do good, be good, serve people, and don't hurt anybody. There is no way that is any way smaller than these concepts. It's almost like Swami is using all of this to say that that's why I'm saying it all boils down to this.
Exactly.
You know, everyday goodness.
Yeah. In fact, if we just relate to all of these as concepts, like just as you're saying, if Om is just a mechanical recitation, if we relate to all of these as mere concepts, which is, you know, ripe for discussion and you feel very intellectual about it, in that, then you're actually diminishing it in value.
Right.
Swami is very clear, the only way you're going to honor what is said in the Vedas is if you put it into practice. I think that is something very important for us to bear in mind.
I remember, probably we'll end with that, a small letter that Swami had written to Professor Nanjundia. Right? Apparently Swami had gone to his house and while leaving, or I think after coming back, Swami wrote a letter to him. Almost like writing back to your host. So in that letter, Swami had written these words, very, very profound. He said, the best way to spread the principles of Vedanta is to practice it. He said, there is no other way to propagate and spread. And, I mean, what better example than Swami?
Exactly.
You know, when you listen to it over and over again, as you were saying, that for him a discourse was not, you know, delivered and forgotten. He was living that message every day, and it was, you know, waiting for the opportunity to spread it to others and to bless others with that. You know, not just sharing it, to bless others with that knowledge. So I think we'll conclude with that, Hari. Quite a heavy discourse, but it really was something which you know, Swami was taking us through, that pranava, the concept of pranava as it is given in the Vedanta, in the Vedas. So dear listeners, we'll conclude with that. We most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. do join us again next week. We'll continue with this discourse. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the day, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. Thank you for being with us. Happy listening.